The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's the custom for me to use my first Sunday talk of the year to talk about the Four Noble Truths. It's often considered to be one of the central teachings of the Buddha or of Buddhism, and it's a very useful teaching, practical teaching, and it's a teaching which lends itself to a lot of different applications, or we could say a lot of different interpretations. And so I would like to talk about one particular application of this famous teaching, which is found in what's called the discourse, the Buddha's discourse, on turning the wheel of the Dharma. This has the pride of place of being considered the first sermon. They usually use the word sermon, maybe to give it more importance. The first sermon of the Buddha after he was awakened. And certainly the Buddha gave a first teaching some point or other, so that's probably historically accurate. The chances that this particular record is represents what he actually said is pretty small. The particular discourse is canonical, is in the ancient suttas, but it's an excerpt from a longer work that was probably written about at least 100 years after the Buddha died, that was laying out kind of the history of the Buddha's early teaching career. And it's a genre of literature which doesn't really belong in the early texts. The subjects, the topics, the mythology that comes in there clearly belongs to a different period. And so even though it's held up as being the first sermon of the Buddha, most scholars will say, well, it's not quite right. But that shouldn't worry us too much, if though the teachings in there are useful. And we find they're useful, they are useful in that they're applied in a particular way. Most people who, like myself, Dharma teachers, who will talk about the Four Noble Truths and refer to this first discourse of the Buddha where he supposedly talks about the Four Noble Truths, will say this is what the Buddha first taught, he taught the Four Noble Truths, and then they proceed to tell you what the Four Noble Truths are. And they mostly... it's like cliff notes, what they say. They mostly kind of have read very selectively what the text says, and then they kind of expand from there. But what I'd like to do today is to kind of really dig into the text, the part that's often ignored around what this is being talked about. And you'll see it's a particular application of this teaching that if you take it most literally, maybe some of you find it useful. But if we take it as more figuratively, that maybe it's useful for all of us here. So as an introduction to this topic, I'd like to do a little maybe analogy or something, a little thought experiment. And that is, imagine that either you have... you know, you can kind of look from the sky down into everyone's homes early in the morning. Or there's a wonderful documentarian who somehow has taken the roofs off homes and been up there in a blimp and is kind of, you know, looking down at people when they wake up from their beds and they get ready for the day and they put on their clothes. And so you know, first everyone is sleeping. And you know, people sleep maybe a little different from each other, but it's basically people sleeping, and you don't know much about them, perhaps, from how they're sleeping. And they come out of their bed, and maybe they have pajamas on, and it doesn't tell you much about them, their pajamas. They're just pajamas, they're disheveled, they haven't had their coffee, perhaps, and, you know, and they're stumbling in the kitchen and getting their coffee ready, and their breakfast, take a shower. And then as they kind of proceed in getting started up for the day, then maybe they're going to work, and so they put on, maybe if depending on the work they have, clothes particular to their job. Maybe a uniform. Some people are firefighters, and they put on firefighting clothes, or police officers, or nurses, or medical technicians, or, you know, you can go on and on what people do. Or maybe people are going off to a place of faith, and so they dress a little bit accordingly, and how people in their faith place are going to usually dress, and maybe, and some places they put on their suit and ties and nice things, and which we seldom do here. I don't see anyone. And so you see that as people get started in their day, they're assuming a role. They're assuming a way of being, a role, police officer, firefighter, nurse, whatever it might be, plumber or something, and they're putting on an outfit that kind of represents that role. But it isn't they're putting on the outfit so people know who they are, or the outfit that's practical for the job. It's with that comes taking on the role psychologically. What it means to be that person, how you present yourself, how you speak, how you hold yourself. And in different jobs, you have a different persona. And so not only does a person put on the uniform, they also put on the persona. They assume a persona. And there's nothing wrong with that, and it's quite appropriate to have different personas in different environments, and not necessarily insincere. It's quite sincere. In this environment, this is how I am. This kind of persona is appropriate. This is what I'm asked to do. And it's what expected and how it all works. The issue is not assuming the personas, but becoming the persona. And the difference between assuming means kind of like you're imagining, kind of like you're just, it's temporary, it's provisional, it's just kind of useful for the moment. I'm assuming a certain role, a certain thing. And if you go to a funeral, we assume the role of a mourner, which in different cultures or different places means a certain, you present yourself a certain way. You expected to dress a certain way and talk in a low voice in a certain way. Other places you show up and it's a party and you expect it to kind of dance. And I mean, to all kinds of different things. I went to a funeral once where the expectation culturally in that group of ethnicity, that ethnic group, was initially a tremendous amount of expression of anger. It was awesome to watch. I mean, it was fury and anger at the person who died. And once everyone had this off their chest, then they proceeded to dance and party and celebrate the person's life. But this was like the last chance, right? So, I think a lot of here in California, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a funeral where, you know, you're supposed to stand up and let the person have it. That's not a persona. The angry persona is not one you put on in our, here mostly. You put on a kind of, reverent, or I don't know how you, but just a persona, a certain way to be. It's expected, we assume it. Sometimes we don't even know we're assuming it. It's just kind of like second nature to do it, that we enter into these different personas depending where we are. So the issue is the difference between assuming it, hopefully appropriately, versus becoming it. And becoming it is a deeper level of identification, a deeper level of this is who I am, and this is how I define myself, this is how I want to represent myself to the world, this is my true nature, and now this is how I have to convince other people who I am. It's not just assuming it for the moment, and it's flexible, and I can take off the uniform and be something else. Now I have to go through life and have this particular way of being, this becoming, this identity, and I have to hold on to it, I have to defend it, I have to champion, and I have to keep constructing it, keep reinforcing it for everyone's sake, especially for my sake, so that it's important to, because I'm attached to it. I really like this, I'm attached to it, it's important for me. And there's a lot of things, and so some people, it's the persona of their profession, that they do it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and it kind of settles in, and they get so identified with it, so used to it, such a habit, that they kind of becomes who they are, and they can't really drop it very easily. Or maybe they can drop it when they retire, but there are a few people who, when they retire, are completely lost, because their whole sense of being in the world, how they oriented, is oriented around having that persona, which required the job. Without that, some people are lost, and they say that some people even die shortly after retiring when there's such a big loss of identity or sense of being or something so challenging. But then there's kind of deeper psychological identities that we take on, some of them which are quite dysfunctional. And, some people have this assumed, they've become the person who's inadequate, the person who's not quite acceptable, the person who's somehow wrong. Everyone else has it together but me, and I'm somehow, something, unworthy, or somehow I'm the one who's always left out of all situations. I'm the one who doesn't, when I was in high school, I was the one no one wanted to listen to. So now I've kind of made up for it. What do you think I took this profession? So then we carry these ideas about ourselves that some are acquired from how people treat us, some are acquired from all kinds of inner maybe insecurities or oversecurities or something. And some of them are conceit. I'm the one who's better than everyone, and so I'm going to compete with you. If you kind of do anything that threatens my sense of being the superior one here, I'm going to compete with you and show you how I'm even better. And so all this, in Buddhist terms, fits under the category of becoming, becoming some identity, being something that's more than just assuming it temporarily. It's taking some idea, and this is who I am. And then being attached to that, and in the attachment to that, suffering a lot. Because when we are attached to an identity, attached to a becoming, it kind of, not much a maneuvering room sometimes, to be flexible and fluid in different environments. And some identities need to be constantly reinforced or defended so it keeps coming up, the energy for it or the satisfaction of it or the proof that we're okay. And if it's taken away or if it's threatened, it's painful and hurtful and it's difficult. Some forms of becoming in and of themselves are painful. If they're negative becomings, we have the negative self-images that we get attached to and hold on to. And just painful to have it. So one way or the other, this idea of holding on, being attached to an identity, is a central attachment Buddhism points to that we want to overcome. And this is the central issue in this so-called first sermon of the Buddha. So I'll describe this, how this works. So the Buddha, in this Four Noble Truths, he lays them out. He first says that there's a noble truth of suffering. And this word suffering is maybe not the best word in English. But then he goes through and he describes what he means by the suffering. And so in this translation I have by Tanisara Bhikkhu, he translates it as not suffering, but as stressful. And so this is the problem. So the first little statement, it says, birth is, in this translation, stressful. The more common English translation is, birth is suffering. But the problem with that is the word suffering has all kinds of associations in people. One is that when you're suffering, it's really big problem. And so it only refers to the biggest issues we have. But another one is that the word suffering in English can be both an adjective and a noun. And so when people read birth is suffering, many people hear it or read it as two nouns. X is Y. And so there's the two are equated to each other. Birth is suffering. That's all it is. And then you go through the rest of it. So birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, suffering. sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are suffering. Association with the beloved is suffering. No, association with the unbeloved is suffering. Sometimes it's true the other way. Association with the unbeloved is stress, is suffering. Separation from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. So that's the usual way. Now this is Tanisiro Bhikkhu's translation. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, and distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from the loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. You get a different feeling, right? And other people prefer the adjective painful. Birth is painful. Aging is painful. When you say birth is painful, it's not like the final story. You know, birth is painful, those of you who've given birth or remember your birth. But for, you know, if you're given birth, there's usually other emotions there in addition to the pain. For some people, it's the highlight of their life to give birth, and even though it's painful. And so using some adjective like stressful and painful gives a little different feeling. And you say, oh yes, I recognize this. There is a lot of pain in this life. There's a lot of stress in this life. And as an adjective, there's a lot of suffering. There's suffering that's involved in a lot of the different things. So this is the beginning of this famous teachings of the Four Noble Truths. And some people find this teaching, just hearing this First Noble Truth, for some people, it opens their eyes. Some people say, wow, finally. I've been struggling and I couldn't understand how difficult life is and everyone's saying it's great and good or something. And now I finally hear the truth. Someone says, yes, life is difficult. It's painful. That's part of it. And some people can relax just being acknowledged that this is part of people's our lives. For some people, it's just depressing to hear this because they don't see it as kind of a truth that finally makes sense of things in some way. So here's the Buddha goes on to explain the second noble truth. And the little kind of way that the title of the second noble truth is like this. And this is the noble truth of the arising of suffering, the arising of stress, the arising of painfulness. So just that, the truth of the arising of suffering. And what is that? And here, what we find here in this text here, is not a, again, not a one-to-one correspondence. It's not like the definition of the second noble truth. Remember, with the first noble truth, it isn't that birth is suffering one-to-one. It's just elaborating or explaining some aspect of birth. One aspect of it is it painful or stressful. So here also we find the same thing. What's going to follow now in the commentary about the noble truth of the arising of suffering is not a one-to-one correspondence. It's not like this is the definition of it. Rather, it's a particular elaboration. It's a particular application of it, which you don't get a sense in many of the teachings of people who teach about this, because most people will just refer to the very beginning of the elaboration. And they'll say, this is the noble truth of stress. This is the noble truth of the arising of stress. Craving. That's the first real word. It's the craving, but it's craving. And people say that craving, or the literal meaning of the word is thirst, that's the cause of suffering. This is what people, very common teaching about the Four Noble Truths. And so we have to understand how craving, thirst, desire, a certain kind, is the source of all our suffering, which is a little bit of a tall order to try to shoehorn everything, all the causes of suffering into particular kinds of desire, this particular one, But, you know, it can be done, and it's very useful teaching to look at desire and our attachments to desire, attachment to craving, that and how, what role it has in the ways that we suffer. And many people who practice meditation and have some sense of stillness and quiet and focus and sense of well-being from meditation can become increasingly and usefully sensitive to see how I have a desire, a craving, a wanting, and how that leads to suffering, to problems, and even more significantly, perhaps, the very desire, the craving itself, is suffering too. But it's just uncomfortable to be craving all the time. So it's a useful teaching. However, when the Buddha, in the so-called first sermon, he didn't stop there. And this is what's usually left out, is the rest of it. And you'll see now that it's a particular application. So he uses the preposition the craving, meaning probably some particular form of craving. It doesn't say just craving, it says the craving that. So the craving that suggests that we're talking now a particular kind of craving. That craving that does something. Okay? The craving that makes for further becoming. Here we're in the word becoming, which I talked about earlier. That's why I did the whole introduction. the particular craving that leads to creating, holding on to these identities in a way that it's Buddhism calls a becoming, as opposed to an assumed persona or something. So, now I'll read them more fully. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there. So, in the ancient world, they seem to have a lot of issues with relishing, over-delighting in certain things. Certainly there's a lot of joy that's emphasized in early Buddhism. It's a very strong, important role. But there's a certain kinds of joy that we don't quite know how to translate in English in a way to capture the nuances, but the word relishing works maybe relatively well. Here he translated it as delight, one of them. I prefer to translate it as delighting, because what's wrong with delight? But delighting means you're into it. And you're leaning in, doing it, kind of engaged in doing the delighting. It's a verb, right? We're delighting. Whereas delight is just like a nice thing. So it's just leaning into a certain kind of pleasure, joy, craving, relishing that gets us caught, gets us caught up in desires, makes desires not just desire, but turns it into a compulsion, which is what craving is. A certain compulsion where you can't put down, you can't stop. It's a strong habit, a strong addiction almost at times. And the way that some people relate to their identity, to their becoming, probably qualifies as an addiction. It's so intense how people are caught up and involved in it, and it's so difficult to put it down, and you might even go through withdrawal, you know, because we're so dependent on understanding ourselves certain ways, certain identities, certain ways of being, and having that reinforced and supported by our loved ones and friends. They all have to get along with and do it. I remember when I was first beginning to see all this becoming identification that I lived under, that I felt like I need to put this down. And one of the things that made it difficult was that my friends expected me to continue being that way. And that was the expectation. That was kind of like part of the understanding of how we'd relate to each other. And if I wasn't going to relate to each other that way, then some of the juice between us, some of the medium of communication didn't quite exist, and it was a little bit hard for the relationship to continue or find a new way to be. And so I actually sometimes reverted back to my old persona, because I couldn't navigate how to stay with my friends when they expected the old persona to be there. So there's sometimes a lot of reinforcement for this becoming, for this persona being a certain way. And then he wants to give a little bit more specificity to what this craving is, what it comes along with. And it's craving for sensuality, sensual pleasure. It's craving for becoming. And then last thing he says, it's interesting, it's craving for non-becoming. So, so craving for sensuality is a kind of in the Buddhist analysis of human beings, and you might not fit this, you might be the exception, that sensual pleasure, comfort, is deeply embedded in a part of human psyche. And it's one of the driving forces of human behavior, is a drive for sensual pleasure. And, you know, if you want to protest, then, you know, you see there's a lot of, at a certain age, when people are teenagers maybe, when a little window when you're 17 perhaps, that, you know, the craving for sex, you know, that would fit under this category that some people have. None of you, but I'm sure that out there. And so the craving for sensuality, sensual pleasure, comfort, is huge. And as I like to say, you can probably do a fairly easy analysis of your own life to figure out how much money and time you spend that's not really needed to live a basically settled, comfortable, supported life, that comes from getting a little bit nicer X, little bit nicer food, little bit nicer clothes, little bit nicer furniture, little bit nicer than you need to car, little bit nicer, you know, whatever it might be. And what's the drive for getting things a little bit nicer than you really have to? Chances are that some of it has to do with straight-ahead sensual pleasure. Just enjoy it. It's pleasant. It's enjoyable. There's nothing wrong. There's no crime in doing that. But we see that this drive for sensual pleasure is strong. And sometimes it becomes craving. Sometimes a drive for a little bit more than what we need, or all this stuff, is not because of pleasure, but because of becoming. I want to be a certain kind of person. I want to be seen as a certain kind of person. I want to prove to myself, or I'm this kind of person. And so I'm going to inhabit this persona or this becoming by making sure that I have these kinds of shoes or this kind of clothes or this kind of car or this kind of something. And so we're shoring up an identity. And how much of our identities are shored up by what we spend money at and what we spend time at doing? So the craving for sensuality, sage's craving for becoming, to be someone. But then there's a third category, which is craving for non-becoming. And some people just really have a strong desire not to be. I don't know if it's that strong, the whole thing not to be, but I lean in this direction in certain ways. Some of you have been around me for a long time here. I think you probably have never seen me with clothes that has a big logo on it. The idea of wearing something that has something written across it, I have a certain, hesitation around, because it feels like now I'm becoming something. And I kind of would rather not to be in terms of presenting myself, you know. And so you know, I'm always presenting myself some way, becoming. I can't get around it. But I kind of lean more in that direction and not becoming. So that I don't want to wear clothes with logo, for example, or statements or sayings on it. It's fine for people to do it. I don't have a problem with other people doing it. Sometimes it's nice to see, but not me. You know, and you know, it kind of goes along also. I think my default, for example, this non-becoming side of me that I have, I would not be sitting in the center of the front of the room. No way. I'd be sitting in the back row somewhere. you know, and out of the way, and so I wouldn't kind of, you know, like this fellow back there in the corner smiling and laughing. He doesn't want anyone to notice. And that's where I would be. So there's non-becoming, but also the craving for non-becoming is also sometimes kind of a negative thing, where we want to become something because we don't want to be something else. I don't want to be X, so I'm going to be a Y. And the creation of identity is partly to avoid identity that we don't want. And some people struggle against identities that sometimes are pretty natural to have because it has to do with, you know, what they look like physically. And there's a lot of suffering, a lot of problems in our society by looks, skin color, size, you know, our size, our ethnicity, or this and that. And we're given all this terrible what we do to each other. We become other people. I mean, that doesn't work in English. We project becomings. We project identities onto other people in ways that are horrific in our society, racism and things like that. So then people have to live with that. And when living on that, some people then want to get away from who they are and try to prove they're somebody else. There's a strong craving to not be that, to non-becoming. And then some people, there's a whole healing process that goes on where they then willing to step into who they are and feel proud about it, feel comfortable and natural and not feel ashamed. Just here I am in a beautiful way. So this whole world of becoming, of identity, is a tender place, is a challenging place, is a place where a tremendous amount of suffering arises. And this is what the Buddha was talking about in his first so-called first sermon. And most literally, probably what he was talking about was not becoming in everyday life, but for him, in a kind of more cosmic scale, because he believed in rebirth, there's the re-becoming in the next lifetime. And for the Buddha, this is not an innocent act. You don't simply die and then just float around and, you know, just pop up someplace and, you know, and just that's how it is, and you're quite innocent. You know, I didn't do it. I didn't do anything. I'm just here. But rather, the drive or the mechanisms or the orientation that gets us reborn in a particular next life has a lot to do with the craving to become. It shapes the kind of next life we have, one of the shaping factors. And so it has a very important role. But one of the things that's interesting is it's simply the act of becoming, or the desire to become, independent of becoming anything in particular, that can get us reborn. Now, if we go back to this lifetime, which I prefer, and look and see how becoming works day to day and psychologically, for some people, the attachment around becoming is not to being anything in particular, is not becoming X, but it's the attachment to just being. The process of becoming, the I am. Some people find it's beautiful feeling to let go of all the different identities, let them go, and come to some very rudimentary, just beautiful feeling, perhaps a vibrating feeling of I am-ness. As if that's kind of like sometimes ultimate. For the Buddha, that I am is still a form of attachment. But non-becoming, the craving for non-becoming, is also a problem. So you're not supposed to get rid of that. You want to get rid of identity, to want to get rid of even the sense of I am-ness, is just to be part of this samsara, part of this complicated swirl and fragility of identities that we go into, this circular way in which they reinforce each other and give birth to new ones and goes on and on. So what's the alternative to Are we trying not to become? Are we trying to become the right thing? Are we? What's the whole relationship we have? These identities that we have. So then we come to the third noble truth, and the Buddha describes it this way, and this is kind of like the good news. And again, this is not a one-to-one correlation. It's not like this is an application of the third noble truth in relationship to this topic of becoming. And this is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, of suffering. It is the remainderless, that's a kind of very absolute term, the remainderless, no longer remaining. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go. Those are great words, great ideas. I think it's worth reading again. So we can do it. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. So again, it's reinforcing in this text. We're talking about a very particular kind of craving. That very craving. It's the craving for becoming, for identity. The craving for identity. Identity is not a problem. It's the craving for it. Assuming a persona is not necessarily a problem. It's the identification, the attachment to it. That's the problem, the compulsion around it, the way we do it. And now we're talking about aspects of the human heart, human psychology, which are really deep. They're really deeply embedded. It's hard to see how this operates. You go around your normal life and busy, it's very hard to see. And it's kind of mysterious why I'm suffering, and because it's kind of the operating system that's below the surface. And that's one of the reasons for meditation, is to get quiet enough and still enough, not for the purpose of being quiet and calm, but for the purpose of having the adequate calmness to see underneath the surface of the conscious mind, to see how these attachments operate, where they live. And we're talking about tender, touching, vulnerable, beautiful aspects of the inner life. And when we're talking about identity and becoming, this is something that's very deep. It's like almost very intimate. It's like when people identify with something, That's touching something or coming out of something that's very precious or deep or something. And so it takes care and respect to look at this and not to feel like we're wrong or bad. But in emphasizing the tender or the vulnerable or the precious qualities deep inside that all this comes out of, is also to emphasize that if we can get quiet enough to really drop down and see this, we're starting to see something very important inside of us. And more than just see, we're getting in touch with some inner quality, some inner aspect of our life that is beautiful, that has potential to support us, that to inspire us, to give life meaning and purpose, that is really, really valuable to base one's life on, that life flows from that. But it's not easy to do this. And so the Buddha has the fourth of the four noble truths. And that's the way this is a particular application of the fourth noble truth. We have to be very careful not to assume this is what the fourth noble truth is. But given what we're talking about here with becoming and how difficult this craving is to deal with, and given that we're looking to really bring a total cessation of some of the deepest, most tenacious cravings we have, and one that's going to do the work for the Buddha of ending the cycles of rebirth, for him literally, for me figuratively, ending the cycles of being caught up in becoming an identity that's such a big part of ordinary human life, we need a lot of help. And so this is the help that he offers in the fourth noble truth. And this is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So if people are interested in doing the deep work, really uncovering and understanding and getting under the surface of our suffering around becoming, suffering around identity, it takes ongoing work, ongoing kind of refining, developing, looking at ourselves in the way that that's represented by the Eightfold Path. We need to have particular view, understanding, or orientation, perspective to do this work. And so we need to learn what that perspective is, which is right view and right intention, right resolve. We need to kind of have our ethical life in order, in just enough order enough, so that we're not agitated around our ethics. We want to have an ethically relaxed heart. Then we can go under the surface and see what's there. But if we have an ethically agitated heart, that just kind of, you know, agitates the waters and we can't see. And then once we're settled enough, that's when we do the meditation practice, which is the last three steps of the Eightfold Path. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration to develop the clarity and the stillness that allows us to touch these beautiful and deep and tender parts inside, that to do it in a way where we feel deeply safe, a deep sense of trust, of inner safety, of well-being, a place where we can really lower our guard, lower our fear, lower our resolve our hates and animosities and resentments, where we can really kind of drop into places where there's no doubt, where we feel so much trust and willingness to breathe and be. And that's the place where something inside, some attachment and craving to identity, can give away, can let go. And what a beautiful thing it is to be able to be in this world without having always having the filter or the lens of being someone for yourself or being someone for someone else. You get to just be. And the idea of what being is, you get to be free. And being free is better than becoming. And if you're free, then you can be more playful around all the different personas you might assume, if you assume them appropriately. It's going to be quite fun to be flexible and fluid and not hold, be different people, like different personas at different times, depending on the circumstance and who you're with. If you're playing with a 3-year-old, it's really good to have different personas. Thank you. So are we having a tea today? So we have the tea today, and which means that it would be really great if you would say hello to one or two people next to you and present your persona. Or confess it. So confess your persona. And anyway, or just say something about what this talk meant for you or something. But be nice, and then all you have to do is say hello if you want. And then you can go. But everyone's welcome to stay for the tea.